You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself, Ryan Walker. In this episode, I'm going to be exploring human factors. And actually, what we're going to do is have a mini-series on human factors. So I'm going to be speaking to three clinicians from across the spectrum of healthcare around human factors and how it impacts their individual tasks and environment, both from their experience, from their clinical practice, and indeed from their recollections on previous events. So what I wanted to do initially is just set the context and give a couple of lectures from my experience on human factors. And then we're going to speak to these clinicians and just really frame the information so that there's real relevance to the information. So what I want to do is look at what human factors are important initially. Just look at some working definitions of human factors. Then we're going to look at the history and origins of human factors. So I think it's really important to know where it's come from. And then look at the main domains of human factors. We're going to also look at, so individual human factors and mitigation, task human factors and mitigation, environmental and system human factors, and then the mitigation for them. We're going to look at NASA as a seminal case study because they were one of the first institutions to really notify the world, or indeed their own employees, of human factors, the presence of human factors. And then we're going to look at a couple of seminal cases from history. And so this is going to be the first episode, which I'm going to take. And then what we're going to do is interview these three clinicians, and they're going to run us through their cases and why human factors are so fundamental to them. So the reason why I'm focusing on this is I really do think that human factors is an integral part of what you do as a clinician. And if you choose to ignore the human factors, then I think you are at risk both clinically, but they are certainly working in the background. And we should and indeed do have mitigation strategies for these. So before I crack on, please do rate and review the podcast. It's great to get your anecdotal feedback, but also get your perspectives on what other content would be useful to see. I've started screening these episodes on YouTube, so please just look for the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on YouTube and you'll find me there. So you can start to watch these. This is actually going to be a presentation, so it might be really worthwhile going to YouTube and watching this presentation, because if you're listening to the audio, there will be vital pieces of information that you'll see if you look at the visuals. What I'll also do in the show notes is put links to some fantastic content on human factors. So some videos, some seminal videos, and also some PDFs from institutions like NASA and their approach to human factors. All the information is in the public domain, but what I really want to do is start to frame this information with some really useful and interesting cases. They are tragic cases rather than fantastic, but they really frame and compound the information which is going to be contextualized within the presentation. Like I said before, we're going to look at why human factors are important. We're going to look at definitions, the history, the three domains, individual, task, and environment. We're going to look at NASA and human factors. And then we're going to look at two seminal cases. So this picture says it all, really. And if you're just listening to this podcast rather than watching, what I'm showing here is two medicine boxes, one saying noradrenaline, one saying dexamethasone. Both with the same signage, same color, same size box. So essentially they look exactly the same, and this picture absolutely typifies human factors. So, you know, it might be hour 13 of a 12-hour shift, so you're an hour over your end of shift. You are struggling to give a patient, maybe they've got acute COPD issues, or indeed COVID-19 symptoms, and you're looking to give them dexamethasone, but the noradrenaline looks exactly the same. And this is something we're going to tackle within the presentation around these latent human factors or system human factors, which actually make life and the job more difficult and can actually increase medical error. Okay, so the cost of medical error, this is really prudent to look at this because there is a number of figures being bandied about, but they say upwards of sort of 200,000 number of avoidable deaths from 2020. So that's 1 in 10 patients develop healthcare acquired conditions during hospitalization due to human factors. But 200,000, the precise number is 206,020 patients of avoidable deaths. That's massive. So the percentage of sentinel events reported by the Joint Commission between 2005 and 17 resulted in patient death was up to 52%. Was related to human factors. And also just looking at its reporting, so there might be a little bit of reporting bias here, but actually what we when you dissect down the data, you look at across the spectrum of medicine, the hierarchy of use cases, or indeed the hierarchy of human factors, is unintended retention of foreign bodies within body cavities, maybe post-surgery, falls. Then wrong patient, wrong side, wrong procedure, suicide, delayed treatment. So all these constitute fundamental, either individual task and or environmental, or system human factors. So if you want to contextualize this within pre-hospital care, a classic case would be failure to shock VF or indeed delay to shock VF resulting in a delay to treatment. And this might be just through to a myriad of information, lack of signage of the screen, lack of maybe notification. There's lots of latent or and/or background noise. But there's a real sort of noise versus signal, and the clinician can't focus or indeed recognize the VF over a myriad of other information in the scene. So our job really is to look at trying to differentiate the priority, trying to expedite treatment that's life-saving and necessary, and indeed make that clearer and more concise for clinicians on scene. Okay, so a working definition of human factors from Catchpole 2010. This is enhancing clinical performance through understanding and optimizing the effect of teamwork, tasks, equipment, workspace, culture, and organization on human behavior and abilities. And this is most important, the application of that knowledge in the clinical setting. So what that definition is looking at is how can we make the clinical practice easier so that you can apply the right knowledge in the right time in the right place. Another working definition from the Health and Safety Executive 2021 is that human factors refer to the environmental, organizational, and job factors, and also the human individual characteristics which influence behavior at work in a way which can affect health and safety. So fundamentally, human factors is about patient safety. So I'll say that again. Fundamentally, human factors is about patient safety and making and optimizing patient safety. So a third definition, and it's important to include this because this is from NASA 2019. Human factors is the discipline of human factors advances. So human-centered design and operations of complex aerospace systems through analysis, experimentation and modeling of human capability and performance. So what it's really doing is it's trying to deconstruct complex systems through experimentation, so iteration, modeling of human capability, so understanding the capability of the human brain, the short-term and long-term memory, and the human performance. So what we're trying to do is make tasks easier, task acquisition, task execution easier for the individual by understanding the limits of their performance. Okay, so some seminal historic work. So in 1960, in the Journal of Chronic Diseases, there was an editorial of Misses in Medicine. So this was from Japanese and Safran in 1960. And this of Misses in Medicines was a review of the literature on prescribing writing. So what this was looking at medication errors that are common within practice. And this denoted a number of medication errors, but also just denoted and was one of the first to bring to light the commonality of poor handwriting, illegible handwriting, and incorrect dosing. Also, the use of abbreviations and symbols. So the use of this speaks to this inferred or indeed imparted knowledge that you know what the three-letter acronym actually stands for, but it can actually lead to confusion and error. So actually making handwriting and or information simple to understand. So they spoke about electronic prescribing systems that reduce medication errors, and indeed stopping the use of these three-letter acronyms or unambiguous language. So just making language unambiguous so it's clear, concise, and can lead to less medication errors. So they were one of the first journals or indeed articles to start to denote how we can start to mitigate these errors in information passage. Another seminal case was To Err Is Human in 1999. And this was a landmark report published by the Institute of Medicine. And it just shed light on the prevalence and impact of medical errors within the United States. So some of the takeaways were that medical errors were the leading cause of death and injury in the United States at this time, that it wasn't actually the fault of people. So it wasn't due to nefarious people or bad people. It's actually the fault of systems that are prone, that actually disable or enable human error. It was looking to denote and shift from a culture of blame to a culture of safety. And this was just the start of looking at this sort of culture of safety over culture of blame in the early 2000s. It also denoted that patient safety was at the heart of human factors, and that what we can do is we can use multimodal approach of leadership, workforce education and training, effective use of technology, and collaboration amongst stakeholders to combat human factors. And it also denoted, and this is really important, that actually patient involvement and engagement are critical components. Getting feedback from the main stakeholder within healthcare is fundamental to changing systems, changing the way tasks are run, and indeed the approach to individual human factors as well. Okay, so three meta domains of human factors. This is individual, task, and environment. Environment being institutional, could be system based, and tasks are fundamentally the medical tasks which are being applied to the patient. And then individual factors are far more intrinsic. So they can be intrinsic factors which look more like the fatigue, indeed, whether you're well rested, whether you are hydrated, whether you've had some food, whether you've been to the toilet, whether you've been fully briefed, fully trained. So they're intrinsic human factors. And we'll talk about that more as we go on. Okay, so this is another model of human factors. And this is, again, this falls into line with the three domains of people, an intrinsic focused organization or system based, and then work design or task. And these really are the three main domains. So the individual one. So again, we spoke to before around sort of fatigue and or stress management. Fatigue and sleep are common denominators amongst all clinicians. Fatigue and sleep are commonplace amongst all clinicians. You don't have a choice as to whether you have to deal with fatigue. It's absolutely critical to every clinician. So it's how we deal with this as it is a use case as to whether we practice safely. So decision making, command gradients, situation awareness, chunking, attention perception, and we'll talk about mitigations from these shortly. These are quite often intrinsic human factors. So Cliff Reid, amongst others, speaks to this sequential monologue. And it really is this step up. So self, team, environment, patient, and then updates and priorities. But what it is, it's on the individual to look after oneself. So are you well slept? Are you well hydrated? Have you had some food? Is the team briefed? Is the team know what the division of labor looks like? Is it cohesive? Is a clear, commonplace and coherent communication? Have we mitigated the environment? Have we won the environment? Have we made the environment easier to operate in, such as the pit crew concept? So do we have standardization? Do we have the monitor to the left? Do we have the airway bag right to the right of the patient's head? Do we have the crash trolley in clear line of sight? Do we have the team leader stood at the foot end that can see everybody? And then only then comes the patient. And then we've got these updates and priorities, and this is a regular cadence of updates and priorities. So individual human factor solutions. So avoid reliance on memory. So the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, your short-term working memory is poor at best. So avoiding reliance on short-term memory is fundamental to safe working practices. So make things visible and coherent, and that might just be verbalizing and visualizing to other people what you're just about to do, what drug you're just about to give, what intervention you're just about to do. So review and simplify processes. So break them into micro tasks, but never too many, and nice simple processes to make them as achievable and as compliant at 4 o'clock in the morning as 4 p.m. in the afternoon. Standardization is absolutely key. Using checklists, and we'll talk about this in a second, to mitigate reliance on short-term memory, and then decrease reliance on vigilance, because we know when fatigue sets in, vigilance drops. So this is a classic case, and if you can see the screen, don't worry if you can't, if you're listening to this on podcast, I have upwards of 25 numerical and alphabetical characters on the screen in sequence. Now, the working memory, if I was to show you this for 10 seconds, could probably retain 5 or 6 of these, maybe 7. So Miller's magic number 7, plus or minus 2. You cannot retain 25 sequential pieces of information. But if you chunk information down to 3 or 4 letter acronyms, if you chunk them down, they are far better retained. So chunking information is a individual and task-based mitigation strategy to facilitate retention and also facilitate understanding of information as it comes across. Okay, task-based. So kit organization is key, absolutely key. Organizing your kit so you can visually see exactly everything you need. Simplifying kit is also key. So making sure there's not too much kit, there's clear signage. And one thing I learned quite early on from doing a lot of expeditions was, if you have multiple expedition medical kits, have them all ordered in the same way. So that actually, if someone else is opening the kits, they know that things are exactly the same way, that and in exactly the same place. So the airway kit is always up on the right and it's in a different color. The breathing is up on the left. The circulation or mass hemorrhage is in the front pouch, but it is the same on every bag. So systematization of task is absolutely key. So some of the increased errors we look at and indeed are familiar with is just so shortage of time. So rushing procedures and trying to make sure we've got adequate time to execute a procedure. Inadequate checking. So we always say that actually you're only as good as the kit you've checked. Poor procedures, and that might just be poor procedural performance across the domain, but maybe it might have been poor procedural rehearsal. So how have you practiced the skill? Because how you practice is quite often how you will perform in real life. And then poor equipment, human equipment interface. So how, you know, is it a complex piece of kit to use? Is it overly complex? Is there lots of complicated tasks interlinking? And how can we de-escalate that? How can we simplify that? And then the classic case is unfamiliarity with the task. I never say that word. Unfamiliarity with the task. So becoming familiar with the tasks in training, so when you execute it in reality, it's only a short step to actually task execution. So we say sort of train hard, fight easy. Train hard, fight easy, which really is around this high fidelity simulation, trying to mimic reality as much as possible, trying to make training as difficult as possible so that when it comes to task execution or indeed just patient care, you already have analogs of really difficult analogs of practice. So train hard, fight easy, so that when you have a difficult patient in front of you, you rise to the level of the challenge, you rise to the level of your training, or indeed fall to the level of your training, but your training really does back you up. Okay, task execution, and this is really around, like we talked about before, the pit crew concept. So knowing where your kit is going to be because it's in the same place every time. And actually, when you look up, if you're at the airway, the team leader is in the same place. The person doing CPR is in the same place, and the person that's going to come in and sub out the person who's doing CPR is right behind that person. So there's a clear sequence, and it not only looks organized, but what it does is it allows for simultaneous activity, which is absolutely key. Okay, so the PACE acronym. So the PACE acronym is really around an escalation of alert. And so it is really around probing. So are you sure you're doing the right thing? Then escalating to alert. So repeating the concern. Then looking at challenging the treatment. And then it is about externalizing or declaring the emergency. So it's escalation to an emergency. So it's declaring the emergency, right? This is an unsafe procedure. I want to come out of the airway now. It's moving through that probe, alert, challenge, and emergency or declaration of emergency. Just to make sure that things are safe. But what it is, it's reliant on this, on setting a command gradient, which is flattened. So allowing people to speak into your practice and you speaking into other people's. Okay, so we talk about checklists, and we spoke about checklists before, and this really is fundamental. And what it's doing, it's starting to use either colorimetric or indeed visual checklists on the ground, so that you can use your attentive, conscious working memory to focus on some of the pinch points, some of the troubleshooting, and you don't have to remember upwards of 25 pieces of kit or where they go or where they come from. Okay, so using checklists as much as you can, but not overly using checklists, so you're still thinking about how you can improve during the procedure or indeed during the scene. Close loop communication, and this is absolutely fundamental. What it's doing is ensuring the receiver has the same information as you as the sender. So just making sure the received information is accurate and it comes back to the sender. And I'm sure anyone who's listened to this podcast over time has heard me and or others bang on about closed loop communication. So environmental or system based. Now, one of the things for everyone who's practicing pre-hospital care knows around how differentiated and or extreme the environment can be. And that could be in the middle of London, it could be in a heavily urbanized setting, wherever in whichever country in the world, or it could be in a rural location. In a heavily urbanized setting, it might be poor lighting, it might be noise pollution, it might be extremes of temperature, it might be bystanders. It might be rain and weather. Certainly in a rural situation, environmental factors such as rain and or cold and or hot and or wind certainly play more of a feature. But these environmental factors can dictate the practice. And if we don't mitigate them and win them early and or change the place and or position of the patient to try and mitigate them, they will affect clinical care. They will affect clinical care. Okay, so what we want to do, this also includes system-based engineering human factors. So with environmental factors, looking at system factors we want to really drill into. Are we setting ourselves up to fail? So are we designing errors, not purposely, but through non-purposeful design errors into procedures? So are there any specification errors, such as non-accurately defined system workflows? Are there design errors, such as design is too complex? Are there maintenance errors, so that actually doing a daily test on a procedure on a piece of equipment or a monitoring piece of equipment is too complicated to show compliance to? And finally, are there any errors in the design of information flow? So most importantly, in the pre-hospital phase of care, it's fundamentally about handoff of information. Are we preventing effective handoff of information through maybe not using a simple tool such as SBAR or such as ATMIST to show sort of and give sequential information? So it really does map across the domain. Okay, and it really is looking at some of these rate limiting steps. So what can we do to combat this? Well, we could use training and education. We can use standard operating procedures to measure baselines of compliance. We can look at workflows. We can look at reporting, sort of error reporting and feedback, because what we want to do is we want to start to track commonality of failures. We want to start to track commonality of patient safety issues, because it's the data which will show us where the issues are. So fundamentally, it's using data-driven informatics to show us where the tasks are failing the clinicians and or where the systems are failing the clinicians as well. Okay, so a classic example, and this is not medical, but everyone will resonate with this, in the era before we had electric cars, the misfueling costs of Australian motorists were $10 million each year. So the average repair costs for the average household were $7,000. And this is around putting the wrong fuel into your tank. So it might have been diesel into a petrol car, or indeed petrol into a diesel car. And again, it's system-based error. So actually, an enabling system is the fact that the nozzle and or the pump fits into the tank. Actually, if you factor that out, if you design that out of the system, so you can't physically fit a diesel pump into a petrol engine or into a petrol tank, when you can't physically fit a unleaded nozzle into a diesel tank, then what you're doing is you're breaking the design flow, you're breaking the system, so that actually what you're doing is consciously and or subconsciously you're breaking it's a circuit breaker pattern of habit, so that you're reducing the error around refueling. So this might just be, it might be the design flow from the actual pump itself. It might be the color coding of the pump. It might be a sticker warning. And we do see that in practice. We see lots of sticker warnings, both on the cars and on the pumps themselves. Okay, so system factors mitigation. Again, it's setting people up to succeed. So good design and looking at user workflows is absolutely key. Looking at the data, looking at near misses and critical failures, looking at seminal events, good and bad. So looking at never events, why something went wrong, how it went wrong, and getting to root cause analysis. But also, and this is absolutely fundamental, it's around a safety culture. So embedding a culture of safety within the institution, and that might just be around understanding some key behaviors that you want staff to adhere to, looking at the frameworks in which we do everything, and then also just creating the environment set up to win. So actually dissemination, wide dissemination of the data, and indeed of system-based failures, of where we're failing at the moment and where we need to improve. Also look at, and quite a few institutions do this, around reporting excellence, so medical excellence. So it's not just about reporting failure, but reporting excellent practice, but also reporting and disseminating critical patient failures and commonality through the data to make everyone aware. So this shared mental model. And it's really important, just before I move on, to appreciate how you are communicating that to clinicians. So are you doing that in PDF format, or are you doing that in a multimodal form? Are you producing podcasts? Are you producing YouTube videos just for reporting, or internal videos and PDFs? How are you communicating so that staff cannot fail to recognize and or acknowledge some of this critical information? So just bringing it back to Expedition, it's about winning the environment before you win the patient. Fundamentally, in an Expedition environment, a lot of patients get cold really quickly. Hypothermia mitigation is one of the first things you want to do to try and win the patient over the environment and orchestrate clinical care. So this brings me on to NASA Humor Factors. So NASA was one of the first organizations to study humor factors, and it truly started to become a world-leading institution and expert body of people that really recognized quite early that because astronauts were operating in a complex, unfamiliar environment with lots of equipment and often changing environments, they needed to have human factors mitigation in order to succeed. So this was looked like guidelines for design, displays, and selection of crew members. So they're one of the first institutions to really start to put together a selection process, which not only acknowledged human factors, but put human factors central into the dynamics of teamwork and indeed how individuals mitigate human factors as well. So they led the way with the importance of human factors, and it started with the design phase, but really bled all the way through to how they orchestrate tasks and indeed how they mitigate individual human factors. So they put together something called the Dirty Dozen. So the NASA Dirty Dozen are 12 human factors which really typify and are most commonly seen within practice. So number one was decision making. And this is around the fact that decision making can often be quite inadequate with insufficient amounts of information. We don't often get a chance to do balanced risk assessments because we don't have all the information in front of us. So bringing forth critical information to make good decision making. Number two is communication. So making sure there's appropriate transfer of information across the platform, across the system. So making sure that critical information is passed and received well. Number three is organizational operations. This is the backbone of policies, procedures, and indeed compliance to SOPs. Number four is supervision plans and or inappropriate operations. Just so making sure that everything is planned well. So supervised appropriate operations as opposed to inappropriate operations. So making sure it's planned again, tested again, making sure that everyone has mitigated risk as much as possible and worked the problems. Number five is technological environments. So making sure that the environment is set up to win and not to fail. So it doesn't create risk, it mitigates and reduces risk. And that's everything from the communication equipment, making sure that there's two or three different modalities, two is one and one is none. And then the warning equipment, making sure that the warning and signage is clear front line and center so that astronauts can be aware of when there's a critical failure or indeed when there's a subacute failure. Number six is skill-based. So making sure that that skills are appropriately, consciously, and then unconsciously rehearsed over time. So in the critical care environment, you know when you have truly integrated a skill is when you can start to rehearse it, hopefully proficiently and effectively, subconsciously. So there's a lot of subconscious work that goes into practice. And often when you've been doing a role for quite a long time, The majority of your day can feel like subconscious practice, but it's also good to test those subconscious presuppositions just to make sure that they are correct and you're doing the right things. So that skill base is number six. Number seven is organizational resources. So make sure that there is enough sufficient resources, budget, equipment, facilities, and technology. Number eight is inadequate supervision. So that's really around mentorship and making sure that there's been adequate mentorship across the spectrum. Number nine is psychological condition. This is really important. Your psychological or mental health state. Absolutely, over time, NASA have done a lot of testing in deep water, so Aquarius reef based, and other analog environments such as the South Pole, whereby they try to see how group dynamics and individual dynamics affect mental health over time, and how you can mitigate poor mental health over time. So number 10 is violation, and violation is around workarounds. So it's almost around this normalization of deviance. So what's the workflow look like? Is there any normalization of deviant behavior? Both from a crew perspective, but also from an engineering perspective, is there any deviance in workflows and or indeed in procurement and assembly? Number 11 is cognitive factors, and this is around attention. We know that attention fades over time, so the fatigue is a massive interplay with attention. So having circuit breakers to make sure that attention is retained and democratized, shared amongst the team. So number 12, the final one, is the physical environment. Just so make sure that the physical environment is as safe as possible. And that's just simple things around maybe what the actual workstation looks like, make sure there's no obstructions, but also just make sure that there's sufficient lighting and or ambient lighting when it's required. But just everything from the workflow to the lighting to the sound and background and foreground sound, and just making sure that it's set up to win, so set up to create effective team working. So the NASA Human Factors Analysis and Classification System is something that's really interesting, actually. What it does is it buckets some of these human factors into four main domains. It recognizes some seminal models as well. So the Swiss cheese model is a seminal model, and that's James Reason's model that he posited in the 1990s around that there's four slices, maybe sometimes even five, of potential error. There's both active and latent errors in the system. So active errors are the ones which are both active and will impinge practice now. Latent errors are ones which might not be active now, but what might be active in the future, or just waiting to cause or create risk. So the main buckets are acts, preconditions, supervision, and organization. So acts are influences or factors closely tied to the mishap. So it could be decision making, could be judgment errors, could be skill based errors, could be perception errors. So what individual acts maybe have caused this critical failure? Preconditions, and these are largely environmental factors. So what was the physical space? What was the technological space? What was the communication environment like? Was there any self or team imposed stress? So what was the environment like at the time? So that's preconditions. Next is supervision. And was there adequate supervision? Was there adequate mentorship? Was there adequate gateways that the individual moved through from a training perspective? And then finally, it's organization. Is there any latent factors within the organization from a policy, procedures, resources, and or facilities, but mainly from cultural? So what's the culture? Is it a culture of safety? And so is there any attributes from an organizational perspective that they need to change? So what they do is they've got a human factors investigators checklist, and I'll put the link to this in the show notes as well. And this really looks at acts, so decision making, skill, perception, violations from acts, preconditions, so the physical environment, technical environment, communications, self-imposed stress, awareness, psychological, physiological, medical and perception, then supervision, so failure to correct a known problem, inadequate supervision, planned inappropriate operations, and then violations, and then finally the organizational, so culture, organizational resources. So they're the main four buckets. And then they go through meticulously to attribute any failures to one of these four buckets so that they can work on them, dissect it down to root cause analysis and fix the problem. Okay, and then what I'll do as well is I'll put in the show notes the work, the flow charts, the main domains within the flow chart. And what this really does, there's a lot that can be sort of taken and cleaved from this. It's just around the way they approach system failures and or human failure. And so it's really interesting. So I'll put the link in the show notes for the flowchart. You can just see how they approach different types of failures. And there's a lot can be learned that can be extrapolated to pre-hospital care practice. So finally, as we come into land on the episode, I'm going to look at a few seminal cases in human factors. What we wanted to do, what I wanted to do, is really get three people on the podcast that can speak to their own anecdotal cases in human factors, which I will interview them for, and just so that they can dissect it, and we can really start to frame this information around some working cases and examples. These cases are quite well known, and they really do typify what it is to fall prey to these systematic human factors. So the first is a case from Bud Holland. Bud Holland was a rogue pilot which crashed his B-52 bomber after having maneuvered it beyond its operational limits at low altitude. So he had been known to be a rogue pilot for a number of years. He had a track record of flying beyond his operational limits and indeed the operational limits of aircraft. And by the time the fatal air show practice occurred, his squadron commander insisted that he alone would fly with Bud Holland to keep him in check. I'm going to put a link in the show notes to the video of the B-52 crash on the 24th of June 1994 in Fairchild Air Show. And it just shows around the normalization of deviance, because it was both unwarranted. So he went past the angle of attack, so he started to stall the aircraft at low altitude. But it was a catalogue of unwarranted and unconfronted and ultimately dangerous behaviour from Bud Holland, which killed both him and the crew. So the lesson here to be learned is about lack of escalation of concern and action through known escalation techniques can cause critical failure from risky behaviour from an individual. So in this case, it was also revealed that not only decision-making contributed to the crash, but there was also underlying organizational cultural factors within the US Air Force at that time, which contributed to crew's errors. So these factors included lack of training, lack of support for crew members, a culture of aggressive leadership and performance, and a reluctance to acknowledge and address human error. So in response to the incident, the US Air Force implemented a number of changes to its training and safety culture, including greater emphasis on human factors training and indeed looking at the development of new safety management systems. So these lessons from Bud Holland were seminal human factors lessons, which demonstrated the importance of addressing individual risky behavior and indeed organizational factors to preventing future incidents from occurring. So it really did, this case in 1994 really did raise awareness around escalation of strategies, such as the escalation techniques of probe, such as the escalation techniques of PACE, which is probe, assert, challenge, and escalate and or emergency. So it's this declaration of emergency when someone is doing a risky maneuver. Second case is the case of Elaine Bromley. So Elaine Bromley was a patient going in for a routine operation, and this routine operation in 2005 was a routine nasal operation whereby she was otherwise fit and well. But Elaine Bromley, after what was potentially a routine induction of anaesthesia, had unexpected difficulties. So the team started to struggle and had prolonged attempts at securing her airway. So Elaine Bromley suffered a catastrophic brain damage and died 13 days later from profuse brain swelling and indeed hypoxia. So the issues around the case were failure to couldn't intubate, can't ventilate. So the airway assessment was pretty routine, I believe, the day before, but with poor mouth opening. Noted on the notes, but soon after attempts to cite a supraglottic airway and indeed ventilate with an oral airway, it was extremely difficult. The oxygen saturations for Elaine Bromley dropped to 40%. Heart rate started to drop, but before they dropped to 40%, there was plenty of chances to reverse this procedure. So come back to bag valve mask ventilation, or indeed look at front of neck access if bag valve mask wasn't going to work. But what happened was this sequential steps of tunnel vision, of analysis by paralysis, and deciding to proceed with the procedure which was failing. Several attempts at laryngoscopy by two different consultant anaesthetists failed, and they were faced with this can't intubate, can't ventilate scenario. So after 20 minutes of attempts, they and again the falling SpO2, so the falling oxygen saturations went down from 90 to 80 to 70 to 60%, finally dropping to 40%. So they finally managed to manage her airway. But all of this time, whilst ever there was a profound episode over 20 minutes of hypoxia, the nurses around the theatre bed knew what to do. They knew the front of neck access kit was nearby, but there was a profound command gradient within the room. There was no one asking for help, no one asking for solutions. There was tunnel vision. There was very much an authoritarian influence within the room from the consultants and anaesthetists. But the front of front of neck airway kit was never opened. Until it was too late. So they managed to reverse the anaesthesia until she started to spontaneously breathe. But again, the hypoxic brain injury was too profound at the time. And it was found on a retrospective root cause analysis that there was this lack of communication, lack of teamwork, and this was what led to serious harm through this hierarchy of authority. So Martin Bromley, as a lot of you will know, went on to form the Clinical Human Factors Group beyond 2005, and he has done some amazing work within the domain. And this is really around just not only acknowledging but starting to teach some of the seminal tools to recorrect some of the profound individual, task, and team human factors which can be at play. And also look at the what effective communication looks like within the domain of medicine. And I will also put the links to the video in the show notes for people as well to watch. Okay, and the final case is one where it's actually quite relevant to practice at the moment, because only the other day, both Airbus and Air France were exonerated from corporate manslaughter from the Air France flight of 447 back on the 1st of June in 2009. So this is a Air France flight flying from Rio de Janeiro to indeed Paris to France. And on board this flight, approximately 4 hours into the flight, they started to experience trouble as they went through what they call the intertropical convergence zone. So it's a band of high pressure within the encircling the equator, which can constitute a lot of difficult weather for aircraft and indeed storms as they navigate through it. So this led to the aircraft at approximately 40,000 feet, all the ailerons, so the air notification, speed notification, altitude notification tools started to freeze. So they couldn't differentiate which to believe and which not to believe. This resulted in the pilot, the first officer pilot, being in control of the aircraft at critical points within the flight, causing it to stall at high altitude, so approximately 40,000 feet, climbing to almost 50,000, and then stalling and over the process of 3.5 minutes, plummeting into the ocean, into the Atlantic Ocean, killing all 228 passengers. So there was a lot of, this was a seminal case for a number of reasons. So the air, these ice crystals created by the intertropical convergence zone were deemed to cause a lot of technical failures, but there was, on root cause analysis, there was a lot of human error attributed and communication breakdown to the crash at the time. So the interim reports and the final reports denoted that So the pilots didn't notice that the aircraft had reached its maximum permissible altitude, that it did not read the available data appropriately. The stall warning sounded continuously for 54 seconds, and the pilots did not comment on the stall warnings, and apparently did not fail to realize that the aircraft had stalled. So also the pilots didn't escalate the concern to the chief pilot, to the captain, appropriately and or quickly that this was occurring, and indeed that the angle of attack was too steep and was not corrected both in time and shared between the team. So the final report denoted that actually the feedback mechanisms between all involved were poor to identify the application of loss of airspeed, information around the crew, and indeed which metrics and readings to believe versus the ones not to believe. So there was also weakened task sharing from the two co-pilots, and there was a disconnection of the autopilot after approximately 50 seconds, and this caused this startle effect denoted in the report, which led them to both an increasingly emotional charged state, but also a lack of clear decision making to recorrect the stall warnings. And again, so this was multifactorial from a human factors perspective around workflow, around escalation of concern, around appropriate and quick communication declaring the emergency, and around recorrecting mistaken actions. So the first officer was banking sharply to get out of the high pressure and indeed the storm, but what that did is it caused the aircraft to pass this critical high altitude zone, but respectively the captain only realized that the aircraft had stalled whilst it was started to become in free fall. So this is, like I said, a seminal case. It's a case which has just been in the news actually this week, whereby within the courts within France, Airbus and Air France have been mitigated from blame because of this multifactorial picture. And a lot of learning has occurred retrospectively because of this case. And again, it's really around this concept of systems, individuals, and task acquisition. So in summary to the podcast, What I want to do is really draw attention to the importance of human factors, because within aviation, the empirical literature points to the fact up to 80% of aviation incidents can occur because of human factors. So that's 80%, which is extremely high. So identification and awareness are the start of error trapping. So human factors was first recognized by NASA, and they're one of the first institutions to both raise awareness and start to design and train for human factors. And that actually, if we choose to not engage with this, the cost of medical error is too high. The cost of life is too high, and also the second and third order effects of socioeconomic disparity and socioeconomic impacts are extremely high as well. So there's three main domains of human factors: that of individual, task, and environmental. Each domain requires a specific approach to mitigate. So I'll say that again. Each domain requires a specific approach to mitigate these human factors. Just within practice, within principle practice, system human factors exist everywhere. So the best system designs eradicates the possibility of error. So it eradicates the possibility that you can create a critical patient safety issue. And then finally, it's just really prudent to look at this interplay between individuals, task, and organizational, so environment, organization, and systems, because they can all work together to contribute to errors. Okay, I hope you've enjoyed the podcast. There is a couple of areas which I have not expanded on, and I will expand on within another podcast. So we're going to look at different models of human factors. So we're going to look at the iceberg model, we're going to look at the Swiss cheese model, we're going to look at the three bucket model, and we're also going to look at the ESIPS model as well. And look at these four seminal models, how they affect and describe human factors, some of their strengths and weaknesses. And I'll do that on the next podcast. We're also going to have these three interviews where people really bring their seminal cases and how it's affected them. Hope you enjoying the podcast. I'm always open to feedback. Again, I'll leave my email at the bottom of this episode. Please feel free to reach out with content and or feedback. And thanks for listening.
Listening to the Pre-Hospital Care podcast on the Medics Academy Network.